Thanks, Sean. So this is giant work that I've been, this is work that I've been doing as part of the PaaS group at Harvard. So this is a talk about getting different software components to communicate and coordinate with each other regarding some data. And the particular data that I'm talking about is provenance. So the key idea is, how do you synthesize data from different systems so that users can reason about it more coherently? Okay. So what is provenance? Provenance is metadata that describes the history of an object. It includes information such as, what other objects does this object depend on? What applications modified or generated this object? Okay. It's useful in a variety of domains. For example, scientific reproducibility. Right? An example that's close to all our hearts is, we generate some graph and submit it to a conference, and the reviewers ask you to modify the graph in some particular way. You know, at that point, you need to recall which data sets you used to generate the graph, what arguments you used, what scripts you used to generate the graph. So provenance can be useful in this scenario. It's also useful for business compliance. For example, if you want to bust some execs for leaking information before they should have, you can use provenance. It's also useful for security, you know, because it keeps track of dependencies between objects. It can tell you which files were affected by a virus. Okay? So we built a file system called Provenance Aware Storage System, or PaaS. It operates at the file system level, observes system calls, and based on the system calls, it infers dependencies between objects. So here's an example of how PaaS operates. Suppose there's a process P that's reading two files A and B and generating a file C. PaaS records three records internally. So the first two say that the process P depends on two files A and B, and the file C depends on the process P. Okay. So now, you know, in a normal scenario, you have an application that's interacting with PaaS by issuing read and write calls, and PaaS is capturing provenance. But what if the application is also capturing provenance, right? An example of an application that captures provenance is your browser. You know, initially, it doesn't seem like a browser is a provenance system, but you know, it is keeping track of provenance. The provenance is your browsing history, right? It knows what you browsed yesterday or today, and you know, it can tell you which URL you downloaded a file from, right? So now, consider the scenario where, you know, you go to some malicious website and you download a file onto your file system, and then that turns out to be a virus that taints all the files on your system, right? So in this scenario, the browser can tell you where the virus came from, but once the virus hits the disk, it doesn't know which files were affected, right? And similarly, PaaS, since it's operating at the file system level, it knows which files were affected, but it doesn't really know where the virus came from because it has no idea about the application. So from this example, it should be obvious that the provenance that each layer provides is important, right? The browser and the PaaS have a unique perspective about what happened, and both of them are important. So in general, you know, the provenance captured by each system or each layer in the software stack is important, and it should all be recorded. So you might say, well, since the provenance from every layer is important, why not store all the provenance in one centralized repository? And so now we have this gigantic repository where we can run the queries. Well, so the biggest problem with this is you need a mechanism to translate names across layers, right? Because each application layer uses a different naming convention. So your option here is to either translate the names or get the applications to agree on a naming convention, right? So what we propose instead is, you know, get the provenance systems to interact with each other and disclose provenance to each other and ensure that they can connect the provenance together by linking the appropriate objects. Okay, so this talk is about the issues in getting the provenance systems to interact and our approach for solving those issues and our experience in solving it. Okay, so now I've spoken about I've told you why getting the different layers to interact is important. I'll tell you about the challenges in getting the layers to interact. So the first one has to do with, well, you need an interface in the first place for them to interact, right? So the browser knows that it downloaded a file from some URL, but how can it disclose that information to the file system, right? And so it's not just limited to the browser needing to disclose some provenance to the file system. There could be a plugin module that's you know, rendering or modifying every URL that you load in some particular way, and it might want to disclose to the browser that what algorithm it used to modify whatever URL you're loading, okay? And so what we have is a bunch of provenance systems that are stacked on top of each other and interacting with each other. And So the whatever interface you design to disclose provenance should also allow you to stack on one on top of another. Okay. So the next issue has to do with representing objects that are present in one layer but not present in another layer. So for example, you know, many of us use tab browsing, right? So users might the browser might want to like group all the URLs by tabs. So but if it wants to represent a tab on pass, it can't do that because you know, the tab is really not manifest as a physical object on the file system. So the next issue is basically, how do you represent objects that are present in one layer but not in another layer? Okay. So the next issue has to do with ensuring consistency between provenance and data. So you know, suppose the browser writes the data first and then writes the provenance, but suppose that it crashes between before you know, once it writes the data but before it could write the provenance, you could have some data that doesn't have any provenance. So you know, maybe it's not a problem always, but sometimes maybe you use this data to generate some graphs. Later on, if you want to go back and validate this data, you don't have its provenance. Right? And this is more of a problem as soon as you introduce some networks in there. Right? The next issue, this example is slightly contrived, but I had to fit it into the browser example. So you know, has to do with having cyclic dependencies across layers. Okay. So you know, the user might load a URL, which the browser's cache might store as a file on pass. And later on, when the user visits the same URL, the cache might read the file. So you can see that there's a cyclic dependency that I've highlighted in green. Okay. So you know, you can run into cycles that span across layers. And cycles don't really make sense in provenance systems because as soon as you have a cycle, you're just saying that the object depends on itself. So in this, you can say, you know, this cycle just indicates that the cache depends on itself or something like that. Okay. So the last issue doesn't really occur in the browser scenario. It is how do you reconcile objects that have different names in different layers? So one example of this is one layer might be grouping a bunch of objects as a bunch of files as one object, as one data set, and maybe collecting, maybe processing it together or maybe collecting the provenance on it together. So how do you like get the two? The file system only knows about you know, each of these objects as individual. This object considers this object as individual files. So how do you connect the two things together? Okay. So in summary, the challenges are, first, you need an interface for the layers to interact. And then you need to represent objects that are present in one layer but not in another. The third one has to do with ensuring consistency between provenance and data. The next one has to do with making sure that there are no cycles in the provenance you collect. And the last one is somehow trying to solve the naming issue. Okay. So now that I've spoken about the challenges, I'll talk about the interface that we designed that allows the layers to interact. Okay. We call this interface the Disclosed Provenance API because it's designed so that higher layers can disclose provenance to the lower layers. Okay. So there are six calls in all in this API. We also re-architected the pass itself. So pass is basically a file system that's in the kernel. We re-architected it completely so that it uses the API internally. And the API has evolved through three generations, and you know, it's exported to the user-level applications as a library. Okay. So here are the functions. The first two functions deal with consistency. The first two functions are pass read and pass write. They're like regular read and write calls, but the difference is that they also ensure that the provenance is tightly coupled with the data, thus ensuring consistency. So pass read you know, returns along with the data a reference to the data that you just read. So this reference is an object ID and a version. But what this lets the applications do is build accurate provenance records because it knows exactly what data it read and its provenance. Okay. And the pass write call is like similar to a write system call, except that it takes, along with the data, it also takes the provenance that describes it. So since both the provenance and the data are flowing together, you know that they can be consistent. Okay. So here's an example of how the browser might use it. So when the browser downloads a file from some URL2, while it's writing the data to pass, it can also specify which URL the file came from. Okay. So the next function has to do with cycles. We added this function called pass freeze. So whenever you issue a freeze on an object, it creates a new version of the object. So if you go back to our cache example, you know, if the browser, when it's about to read data from the cache, can detect that if it reads it as it is, it'll create a cycle. So instead, what it'll do is it'll issue a a freeze on the cache object, which creates a new version of the cache object, ensuring that there are no cycles. Okay. So the last three functions have to do with dealing with abstract objects. By abstract objects, I mean objects that are present in one layer but not in another. So for this, what we did was we introduced a call called makeobj. It creates a logical object at the pass volume and returns a file handle to the user level. Okay. It's a logical object because the only cost that pass incurs is basically an object ID number that it has to allocate. Okay. And the object that it returns is similar to a pipe. That is, it doesn't have a name. That doesn't even store any persistent data. Any data that you send will be discarded, but it only stores provenance. So this is what we use to represent a browser tab. And internally, pass itself uses this abstract object to represent processes, because we need to capture process provenance, but the process is not really manifest as an object on pass. Right? So here's an example of how the tab might use this. So whenever the browser creates a new tab, it creates an object corresponding to it calling passMakeObj. And so it gets a file descriptor. So when the user visits some URL, the browser issues a passWrite saying that, well, this tab loaded this URL. And similarly, when the user visits a URL 2, the browser issues another passWrite saying that, OK, this tab visited this URL 2. Okay. But it's OK. So you might notice that the process and the tabs have conflicting needs. Right? For the tab, you really need to persist its provenance. You want a record of all the websites that it went. But for a process, you don't want to persist its provenance all the time, right? Because the process could be a read-only workload that's reading a lot of files but not generating any data. So if you manifest it and record its provenance, it's just a waste of space. Okay. So what we did was, we made sure that by default, any provenance that you store with objects returned via makeobj are just cached in memory. And so if it ever becomes an ancestor of a file on a pass volume, then they're flushed to disk. Otherwise, if you want to flush, for example, in the case of the tab, even if the browser doesn't download a file, but you want to ensure that it's persisted to disk, you can call this function called passSync that flushes the object's provenance to disk. Okay. So this is the last of the dpapi calls. So initially, when we designed makeobj objects, we designed them to be of one-time use. That is, once you close the object, you could never use it. Okay. And this was consistent with the process model, where once you exit the process, you can't really recreate the same process, right? So, but when we tried to represent this, when we tried to use makeobj objects to represent tabs, we realized that we were wrong, because a browser. So you might have a bunch of tabs open and you close the browser, but when you restart the browser, the browser will reopen all those tabs. So we needed some mechanism to reopen those objects. So because of that, we added this call called passRevivOpt that takes an object ID and revives an object. Okay. And finally, here's one solution for trying to solve the naming problem. The solution is basically to create an object using makeobj and then link this object to an object in a different layer using passWrite. So I'll illustrate that example with the dataset example. So the application has a dataset that is basically composed of three files on a pass volume. So in order to link this link the data set with the objects on the pass volume, the application can create an object, create a logical object using makeobj, and then issue pass writes that link this data set object to the files. Okay. So now the application can record its provenance, the provenance for the data set as it would normally do, but at the end of it, issue this calls that links these objects. So once you have linked these objects, the user can run a query on whatever level is convenient for him, right? So he can run a query on the data set, or he can run a query on the files. And since it's linked to the data set, he'll be able to retrieve whatever provenance is stored for the data set. Okay. So now that I've spoken about the API that we designed, I'll briefly go over some of the applications that we augmented to disclose provenance to pass. So we call these applications as provenance-aware applications So once if we augment an application to disclose provenance to pass, we call it as provenance-aware. We augmented three applications. One was Lynx, which is a text-based browser. The other one was Kepler, which is basically already, it's a scientific workflow engine, but it already collected provenance. And the last one was we wrote some runtime wrappers to capture provenance in Python applications. So I'll not talk about links because I've been using the browser example right through this talk. I'll briefly talk about Kepler and Python. So Kepler is a scientific workflow engine, and the provenance it used to capture is what operators were used to generate some data. Okay, and by default, it would store the provenance in a file or a database. And then so we modified it so it also stores the provenance in PaaS using DPEPI. Okay, so now I'll just present an example use case that shows the benefit of making Kepler provenance aware. So suppose the user upgrades some library in a system that that in turn corrupts some of the assumptions that the Kepler some of the assumptions of some of the Kepler operators, and because of which they became corrupt. So at this point, if the user uses this corrupt setup to generate some data, obviously he has some data that's not right. So you know, if he discovers this bug after some time and wants to figure out which of his data sets were affected by this corruption. So if he only had a provenance from Kepler, he would know which files were affected by the corrupt operators, but he would not know which of those files were actually affected by the library upgrade. Similarly, if he just had PaaS, he would know which files were affected by the library upgrade, but he would not be able to tell the other round. So what the user wants is basically files that were affected by both the library upgrade and the corrupt operator. By integrating it this way, he can get away. He can figure out which files were affected by that. So finally, I'll talk very briefly about the provenance-aware Python that we developed. So what is the provenance in Python applications? It could be in something as low-level as what were the functions that were used to generate some data, or as high-level as what algorithms did I use to compute these results. So we basically developed a set of wrappers that wrapped some Python applications and intercepted function calls. And you know, it would intercept function calls and keep track of information flow. And when a related file was being written to disk, we would issue a pass write that would link the provenance that we have collected to the write that's happening onto the disk. So this way, we would link the provenance that Python collected to the data that's being written to disk. Okay. And I'll not talk about any applications for provenance-aware Python because it's similar to Kepler. Okay. So now I'll talk about some of the lessons that we learned in trying to make these applications provenance-aware. The first lesson was it's not always trivial to make applications provenance-aware. We still have some ongoing effort in making Firefox provenance-aware, but it's proving to be quite difficult because you know, Firefox is huge and it has a pretty modular architecture. And so if you want to make sure that the provenance flows with the data, we'd have to like modify a lot of the internal interfaces. Okay. And the second lesson that we learned is that APIs are never done, right? Considering that Linux is still adding new system calls, it's not surprising that our DPEPI also has been changing with time. We started with 4 calls, and we've been tweaking those calls, and we've added 2 new calls in April. Okay, and the third lesson was the difference between making applications provenance-aware and making substrates provenance-aware. So we developed our Python wrappers and thought, well, great, we made all Python applications provenance-aware, but that turned out not to be the case because our wrappers don't keep track of some inbuilt variables or inbuilt information flow through inbuilt variables or inbuilt operators. So if you wanted to make Python truly provenance-aware, we'd have to hack the interpreter. So that was one lesson we learned. And finally, here are some guidelines for making applications or systems provenance-aware. So first, you know, identify what provenance is important and change the related system calls, related read and write system calls to pass read and pass write calls. So if you also want to capture some semantic provenance, what you want to do is create appropriate objects using pass make obj, and you know, instrument your application so that you collect the appropriate provenance. You know, you can store those provenance using pass write, or you can cache it in the application. It's up to the application. And finally, when some related data is being written to the disk, link whatever provenance you've collected to the object by using a pass write. And finally, if you're making a substrate provenance-aware, then export the DPAPI so that applications that stack on it can use it. For example, if you're making Python provenance-aware, export DPAPI so that Python applications can disclose any explicit application provenance that they have. Okay. So before I finish, I'd like to say that this talk was a very high-level talk. I did not go into many of the details that we have in the paper. In the paper, we have a we basically redesigned our system architecture so that it uses DPAP internally. So we explained that architecture. I also wrote NFS protocol extensions so that you can support DPAP. You know, as soon as you have NFS, you have a bunch of networking issues. So I talk about those issues in the paper and the new operators that we added. And so throughout this talk, I've been talking about a layer disclosing the provenance to the layers below it, but I've not told you about how you might retrieve it, right? So we actually designed a query language called Path Query Language, or PQL. So this language is based on the Laurel language from Stanford. So this is basically a query language for semi-structured databases. So there's no fixed, so you can run query on arbitrary sort of data sets. So each application layer is not really constrained to by some rigid structure that we define. And we also have some evaluation results in the paper. We ran a bunch of workloads, and I'll say that the overheads were pretty reasonable for those workloads. Okay. So in conclusion, provenance is useful at all layers of the system. It's useful, you know, to some layers will capture the semantics of application. Some layer will capture a system dependency. Some layers might capture what's going on in an interpreter. So it's important to capture all this provenance and integrate them across the layers. And we provided a framework for solving this. Okay. With that, I'll take any questions. Thanks.
Diomedis Pinelis, AUEB. So how robust is this system? Could it be used, for example, for dynamically calculating objects instead of storing them by storing the provenance of how they were created?
So, I mean, it really is up to the application layer. So you can, I mean, we have actually built, you know, I think in the Python, we actually store the provenance in memory, and only when it's manifesting something to the disk do we connect the two. And in the case of the browser, I wrote the browser, I extended the links to be provenance aware, and that we just pump out the provenance whenever we need it to. So it's just dependent on, you can go either way, it doesn't matter. Thanks.
I'm surprised you didn't mention the normal provenance driver, which is, would you be willing to swear in court about the provenance of an object generated from the evidence that you collect? Because that's normally the cutting case is, court-related or legal subpoenas or something like that. Uh-huh. Are you willing to believe what you generate through this enough to swear in court about it?
Well, so there's two answers to that. Not the system that I implemented, but but I think it can be done that way, because whenever people talk about provenance system, they always talk about you can use this in this, you can use it in court or whatever. So I think in theory it is possible. Yeah.
Well, that. No, there are too many people, but in passing, I mean, normally when we answer these questions, the two normal cases mentioned are either legal testimony or passing Sarbanes-Oxley kind of questions. Uh-huh. And, you know, the criteria for the latter is a little bit slacker, but, you know, legal testimony is a little bit greater than that. But in any case, yeah, I think you've answered the question.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
Hi. I wanted to know, with something like the web browser example, when you create the new object that represents the tab, whether that removes the object that represents the browser, or if it's the case that, you know, the tabs differentiate among objects by how they're created, but there's also this meta level of correlation through the browser.
Okay, that's a good question. So I think, is it fair to summarize your question as, is there some containment going on? Does the browser contain the tabs? Is that what you're...
Maybe that's the right way to look at the question.
Uh-huh.
But I was actually just wondering if this is, you're just always adding more links, or if you're also differentiating and saying, say, these files don't depend on each other, because even though they were both written, you know, one was read by the browser and then another one was written, it was in two different contexts that the browser understands internally.
Okay. So it was a simple links-based browser where I didn't run into many of these problems. But to answer your question, the browser knows where the URL came from, and it kind of has some sense of the chain of thought. I mean, or the chain of URLs that a browser I mean, that the user browsed. And so it can separate to some extent, but I can't say off the top of my mind that the separation is super clear or not. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So I don't know if you've ever used ClearCase and specifically ClearMake, but if I just do a wget.yahoo.com, pipe it to grep, and then dump that into a file on the file system, it's pretty clear that the kernel, all by itself, could infer the provenance of that file. You see the connect, mm-hmm. you see the IP address, so maybe you do reverse DNS. You have a pipe going to grep, you carry the information to grep, mm-hmm. and then out of that into the file system. Have you looked at that kind of ideas?
So actually, I mean, if the operations are happening at the command line, pass will just do fine, right? Because it actually keeps track of how, you know, when you do a wget, a pass actually keeps track of what were the command line arguments and stuff like that when it instantiates the process. So it already knows which URL it came from.
Oh, okay.
And
great,
so, I mean, and it also keeps track of information flowing through a pipe. So it, you know, it instantiates the pipe also as an object. So yeah, that's something that I've explicitly tested before. And
that's great, actually. Because I can see that our Firefox being one giant process could be very challenging. And actually, it's interesting because that's where Google has been going with Chrome, right?
Sorry, I can't hear.
Google with Chrome, they have been splitting it, you know, multiple processes, effectively one per tab. I'm wondering if that wouldn't be a better target than Firefox for what you guys are doing.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, the basic problem with we actually were interested in Chrome itself, but the problem was at the time we were working on this, because the first thing is Pass is a Linux kernel. So we needed some browser that runs on Linux.
Sure.
At the time we were working on this, Chrome didn't have a Linux distro. They have one now. I mean, they have something that runs, or some alpha or beta version that runs on a Linux right now. So we are looking into that. So Chrome is more interesting for us than Firefox. Yes.
Very interesting ideas. Thank you.
Thanks.
So apart from the fact that you're a file system group, what makes you think that a file system is the right way to attach to attack this problem?
Well, I mean, to some extent, you know, we're file system people, so we always thought of this as, you know, all objects are going to be there by handled by the file system. So, you know, so for example, the browser might, all it can do is store this, say, it has to write something to a database saying that, well, I downloaded some object, and, you know, so I downloaded some file, and that file and is related to, was from this URL or whatever. Whereas the file system knows that object, it can keep track of the object through renames or moves and stuff like that.
But the file system is such a crude layer to attack this at. I mean, you know, lots of things combine bits of files, but the application is typically the one that actually understands what's going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, the file system hardly knows squat, to be honest. We read 5,000 bytes from here and 2,000 from there, and we spat out 29. I mean, you know, who's to know what did what to what? And, mm-hmm. and you know, it's a very crude sort of thing. Is it really just because you're a file system group and that's the way you approach all these problems? Or I'm not trying to demean it, but, and you obviously said that this was inadequate anyway, right? Because so much of this is being pushed up to the application and, uh-huh. and so forth anyway. So you're tacitly admitting that that's not a huge
part. So I said all of them are important. I didn't say, I mean, it is, you know, it's not complete, right? I mean, the file system, whatever the provenance it gets, is not complete, but I mean, so for example, the use case that I spoke about for Kepler, you know, or Python, if I upgrade some library module, the application has no way of capturing it, right? It's happening at the system level. How do you keep track of that, you know, in your application? I mean, the thesis of this talk was basically that every layer's provenance is important, and we need to find some mechanism to integrate it. So, thank you.